Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, Sports City. It's your boy TP Timeless. I'm stuttering because we're at the beginning of the show. A lot of stuff to jump into. A lot of sport overload over this weekend. MLB opening day is here, people. We got four games to talk about, but I'm gonna save that until the midst of the show. See how people feel about a couple of these games, so on and so forth. There's only two left. The national championship game is set. Can't wait to start talking about everything that went down yesterday. Sports City, I'm focused, man. I hope y'all are ready. I done took off this blazer, loosened up the tie, stepped aside to kitchen. Timeless is alive. Sports City, welcome to the brunch. Let's go.
Oh, welcome to Sports City. TP Timeless is at the helm.
Feeling kind of Sunday.
Moses taking care of the Midwest. I'm TP Timeless holding down the East Coast.
TP, I am ready to back rock.
And the only thing, I got one thing to wish you people.
Good morning.
It's a Sports City chef with Sunday the brunch with Lark and TP.
Good morning.
Kick back, relax, enjoy this everybody, don't turn on the TV.
Good morning.
It's a Sunday morning brunch with Mark, the Moses, and TP Thomas.
Good morning.
So sit back, relax, and 2 hours of facts, and that's a fact, yeah.
The caller number is 917-889-9592. You got the next 90 minutes locked and loaded with Sports City. Y'all could have been anywhere else in the world, but y'all are here with the chefs. And I must tell you, Sports City, like I said, sport overload from, I mean, we could go as far back. Because, look, I haven't been here since Friday. We did the roundtable, chilling on Saturday, man, and had a wide open day for Saturday. Now we're back at the brunch. So you got the Adrian Broner win, you know. Him trying to call Floyd out. Does Floyd come out of retirement for the guy? You know, you got stuff like that. You got Boston knocking off Golden State in Golden State. Like, okay, so that streak is done too. Sports City, I'm happy, man. There's a lot of stuff going on. A big-time matchup. Hopefully I can get Mr. Simmons in the building because it's the Thunder Rockets again today. So I get to talk about that also, man. Like I said, in the national championship, after the Final Four just came down. So I'm putting too much of the dishes out, man. I'm putting the menu out too heavy. But hopefully you people are ready. All right. So let me calm down. I got to calm down, man. Let me gather myself. Calling in by way of the state of Arizona, Mr. Silver in the building. Welcome to the brunch. How are you feeling this morning? Mr. Silver, are you there?
My bad, I had it on mute, and I was talking to everybody but myself. just real quick to start off, you know, thanks for having me here. You know, like I was trying to say on mute, you know, whoever made up the rule that whatever happens bad in threes in your life, you know, whoever made that rule up needs to be shot. And on another note, you mentioned the Warriors, but you forgot FC Barcelona. I know we don't talk big much about soccer, but there was another upset. Two streaks in 14 hours going down, not only the Warriors, but FC Barcelona, too. So, yeah, it's a good weekend, man. I'm feeling good.
Okay, and what happened in threes? What are you talking about?
Well, it's a personal issue. My friend had some there and a couple more issues. That's what I'm saying. Bad things in your personal life. Whoever made that rule up, go away.
Okay.
but
No. I thought you were talking about on the floor or on the ice or on the field.
Yeah, my bad.
No, it's okay. It's okay. You can express yourself. I didn't know that you, you know, going down there, man. I gotta pick you up now. I know what I gotta do. I gotta put this food out. Okay.
You already started, man. It's a good show, Style. I love all you dipped into some of your plates, but I'm loving it already.
Right. I don't usually do that. I just like trying to kick this show off, see how people feel, so I know what type of energy I gotta bring to them. You know what I'm saying? And then just put out the food how I need to put it out. But I said, you know what? Since I'm happy about, you know, opening day being here, I'm happy that I feel good about my boys this year being the Twins. Hopefully they can come out the gate and look good so we don't start out low and they come on strong like that. I hope we can, you know, fly. But we got, the World Series champs in our division, so it's work to do. So with you being here from the get-go, I'm going to feed you. Like I said, I know what type of energy I got to bring to you, so on and so forth. All right. So Friday evening, Adrian Broner fights Ashley Theopane, a boxer from the Money Team. You know, Nate Jones is his trainer. Nate Jones is actually a guy that actually, you know, helps Floyd out while Floyd was boxing in Vegas, in which Broner won the fight by technical knockout. Now, here goes the interesting thing, because this is funny. Broner hits the guy extremely low. He hits him extremely low. Ashley looks at the ref like, yo, he hit me low, like puts his hand up, and the ref thought it was like a body blow and waved it off like the fight was over. So this is how Adrian won the fight, people. Adrian didn't win like by clobbering him. Let me tell the truth. Adrian was getting shots off. Adrian did get his legs kind of leery in the bout, but the guy was, you know, defending well, you know, swaying, so Adrian couldn't end up finishing him off. Ashley didn't hit the canvas once, in which that situation where he got up against the ropes, he tried to, you know, hit him in the body. Ashley ducked, and where the punch ended up landing, it landed straight on the cup, and he was looking at the ref like, he hit me there, and the ref wasn't having it. The ref thought it was a body blow, and this is how the fight ends. Now, the melee after the fight is more or less what everybody's, you know, looking at or talking about because of the week and a half or the past 2 weeks of Adrian Broner's life, you know, what he's doing outside the ring. And, you know, he basically said whether they got a spar or get in the ring and fight, it has to go down. Now, I want to know your thoughts on the fight and the statement that Adrian Broner made Friday evening.
Before I get to the statement, the fight itself, Broner was winning. I don't think I had Ashley winning more than maybe one round, possibly two, at tops at the time he got knocked out or knocked down or whatever you want to call it. You know, this is where years upon years upon years upon years of shady dealings, taking falls, referees taking money, judges taking money, has come and ruined what clearly might be a human mistake. You know, whether or not he's seen it or not seen it, those are his human eyes and those are his eyes alone. He says at the position he was in, he didn't clearly see it was a low blow, thought it was an abdomen punch or something to the stomach. When Ashley waved to him saying, hey, he hit me low, he thought he was saying, you know, I'm done. I can't fight anymore. He thought it was an abdomen shot that might have knocked him out a la Oscar De La Hoya type of thing where he's just hurt and can't fight anymore. So to me, the match was clearly one-sided and Broner was winning. I don't really know what the judges could have had if we would have let it go the full length and finished up what they might have done. You know, we've seen crazier and weirder things in boxing, you know, a la, you know, Bradley Pacquiao in 2012. So things have happened where, you know, we automatically as fans look at this and think shady dealings. We think something's wrong. We think something's run amok. When somebody is hitting a low blow like that, the guy looks to the ref and he calls him, you know, TKO, knocked out. You know, as a boxing fan, that sense of wrongdoing, that sense of, you know, getting paid to take the fall or call the fight early, whatever, that creeps into your mind. But to me, it was a one-sided fight. I felt the ref stopped it because of what he saw. I don't think any wrongdoing was necessarily done. Maybe he had a wrong view of it. If he would have stepped a foot to the right or to the left, he probably could have seen it and called it correctly, which it should have been a low blow, give him a couple minutes to resuscitate himself, get standing, and then finish the fight. After the fight, the calling out of Mayweather and the laughing of Mayweather and Broner being so adamant and really – I mean, listen to Broner's words. He didn't care if they sparred, if it was a street fight, or if it was in the ring. I think Broner just wants to handle their quote unquote mixed words with their hands. To me, this is as petty as it sounds. These are two friends that are having a friendship spat to me. These are two guys that were longtime friends, longtime partners, were in the money team together for several years. Adrian Broner was the Allah apparent to Floyd Mayweather up until the Maidana fight. So I just think some things have been said between these two. And Broner, you know, whether you call it the street mentality, the hood mentality, however you want to classify it, being tough or whatever, he's a professional fighter. He handles his problems with his fists. When it comes to Floyd Mayweather, he feels the only problem he could, the only way he can handle that problem is to fight him. Talking to him, you know, he can't write him a letter, and we all know why. But you know, talking to him and things of that nature, you know, maybe just doesn't work for them. Maybe handling it with their fists is what they got to do. So, does he come out of retirement? I don't know. Depends on what his money looks like. If he needs to stack up some more chips, obviously he will come out like he did before, pick someone and fight him. Will it be Broner? I don't know. Who will it be? Obviously, that's up to Mayweather and his you know, a fighting team and not fighting team, but his you know, front office or whatever you want to call it. Them getting together and picking a fighter for him if that does come to fruition. But to me, with these two, it just seems like an overblown friendship fight. That because of the fact that Adrian Broner, you know, whether or not you like to admit it, he is a multimillionaire, and Floyd being a $100 millionaire, however you want to call it, that they're big. They're in the name. They're in the limelight. So, you know, when we get into arguments on Sports City, people don't blast it all over ESPN and yada, yada, yada. But because of how big they are and because of their names, it's going to get blown up. I think more or less they spar it out. They get into a scuffle or they actually – pastured out. I think most of this can be overblown to me. However, the fight was pretty one-sided, and I just don't know what's next for Broner. Maybe he's calling out Floyd for the payday, like you say, with his personal life. But to me, it just feels like these two just were really good friends and have a falling out. Whether or not they can become friends again or hatch that up is up to them. But I think more or less a lot of people are putting too much into it, especially when you got Broner saying the things that he said after the fight, how he wants to fight him, and he's so street, and you got to see me, and things like that. To me, it just feels like two friends got into it for far too long, and the only way they can feel they can, the only way Adrian feels he can end the situation is to fight him. So it's a big drawn out situation between those two, and then Broner's fighting career. We all know, we talked about it at length a couple days ago about him and what he's going through, and you know, his personal life. But in the ring, last night, he was dominant. He was beating the opponent. He was doing what he was supposed to do, albeit one, if he called there at the end of the fight, I did have Broner winning that entire fight.
Now, before you start to elaborate on where I'm going with it, Jesus, I already gave y'all part of my damn dish. Like, what? Jesus. Like, okay. So, fine. He already did it, so I was hoping that he could finish what I was saying there. But, this is how I look at it, Sports City. I guess I'm going to reiterate it. Floyd Mayweather and him, you know, now, this is crazy that I say it. Floyd is 39 now. He is 39. This is crazy that I've watched Floyd since, you know, 19 till now, in which, you know, all of the stuff that he was saying about Adrian Broner, I mean, they were cool or whatever. I don't even know how they anticipate, because now they have each other's numbers since way back when or whatever. But I look at it as being Floyd, just like Nacho just hit on. Why entertain that? Like, even though he's up there laughing and clapping so on and so forth, and he has statements after the fact, he's like, that's the biggest April Fool's Day joke I ever heard, so on and so forth. And not to even, like, try to egg it on or get the media involved, but if you're going to retire and you got boxes within Mayweather Promotions, you're going to hear people try to call you out, so on and so forth, try to dig you out of retirement. One simple fight with Floyd Mayweather and Adrian Broner is a payday that Adrian Broner wants, whether he wins or loses. Whether he wins or loses. Now, I'm going to be honest. Adrian Broner has the power and speed to probably hit Floyd where Floyd needs to be hit and laid out. But Floyd ain't been practicing or sparring or being in that ring. I know he's probably still in great condition, but him beating you would be everybody's breath of fresh air to see that zero go. You know, and I think that more than ever, he'll stay there just to try and knock you out, just so he could be on top of the world, because he has losses now. Adrian Broner isn't that undefeated boxer right now that everybody's, you know, gawking at to watch him fight. It's more or less a situation where he has to save his career. If he beats Floyd Mayweather, that saves his career. It's like every that's a payday beyond a $15 million payday. Like, and he hasn't even seen that type of payday in boxing. Like, even with Floyd trying to belittle his situation, saying one of my cars is more than what he's made, you know, blah, 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 blah. And Floyd shouldn't even – Floyd, we know what you got. Floyd, we know what you're bringing. You know what I'm saying? And I don't even look at the money that Floyd ices at the end of the day. I look at what Floyd can do in a ring. And let's be honest, this is the one thing that I looked at while they were talking about it during the fight, is Adrian Broner hasn't been successful above 140. When he's in that 147, he's in dangerous ground. And not to say Floyd is a knockout artist, and I don't think Floyd will knock Adrian out, you know, but we've seen Adrian drop twice to Maidana. Sean Porter, he didn't want no parts of Sean Porter. Like, why not get the rematch with Sean Porter? Or just like Floyd threw out there with Terrence Crawford out there, too. There are names. And why is everybody ducking Cal Brook? Like, Cal Brook doesn't get any attention. But meanwhile, this guy's undefeated, too. Nobody wants none of Cal Brook. So there's names out there. But I think more or less the big name that's still around boxing that, you know, still is relevant is Floyd Mayweather. Floyd Mayweather, to me, is kind of like, you know, Michael Jordan or the Kobe Bryant of their sport, respectively, that people want to play before they walk away from the game. So that's the one thing I feel about the Adrian Broner situation. The fight itself, I feel like Ashley Theo Payne, he showed too much respect to Adrian Broner. All throughout the fight, it was more or less he was flinching to the point where he didn't want to get hit. And you're in boxing, even though you're not supposed to get hit, and your object is to, you know, hit, not be hit. It was like Adrian had him kind of on his heels. I don't really want to use the word scared, but he was timid in that fight. So I wasn't too thrilled with Ashley's showing. However, that was a clear low blow. I don't know what the ref is watching. It wasn't like the ref was, like, next to them and he could see this punch be thrown. Like, he at least has a 2 to 3 feet window of being away from these guys while that shot is thrown. And I could see if Ashley looked at him and said, wait, no, no, no. Like, he didn't say no, no. He put his hand up, like and made that face, like, I got hit low. Like, so I don't know if the boxing commission revisits this, which I truly doubt at the end of the day because of the nature of that fight. But I must say that this was an eye-opener for a Friday night fight on Spike. In all of the venues that Adrian Broner has to fight on, whether it's NBC or Spike, like, man, he has to become a prize fighter. I think this would truly be a situation that Floyd actually accepts or takes the bait to help this guy. But after the fight, he said that he's not drinking anymore, he's not partying, he wanted everybody to go out and have fun. So I think Adrian Broner is trying to turn the corner because of how crazy his life was at the given time. So I'm actually happy and proud about that. I'm happy that he's trying to turn the corner and make a better person of himself. But if I'm Floyd Mayweather, I'm not taking the bait. Adrian Broner not worth it. I don't think that is, unless they throw the numbers out there like the Pacquiao fighter. If they throw me the $400 million number, yeah, okay, we'll fight. we'll go into that ring and do what we need to do. But other than that, no, I'm not going in for $30 million. Like, I'm good.
Okay. Exactly. The risk. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead. I was not saying anything else. You get away from it.
Oh, yeah, the risk with Adrian Broner, it's a pretty big risk. Like you said, obviously, the skill set of Floyd Mayweather to hit and not get hit, it's there. Broner is going to take a hit, and we know that Mayweather's not going to knock anyone out, you know, in the first 5 or 6 rounds. Maybe he gets deeper into the, you know, championship rounds, 10th maybe, after he's been punching your face maybe repeatedly, then maybe we can see a stoppage. But to me, the risk for Adrian Broner, for Floyd to fight Adrian Broner is too high for a 15 to even, you know, $35-40 million purse, considering what Mayweather has at stake. He's got a zero and his legacy at line. There's just too much now for him to take that and take that risk, because really, Broner, like you said, it only takes one from him. He can get massacred for 5 rounds and land one in the 6th, and it's night-night all over. And that's serious. It's not a joke. Adrian Broner could get mollywopped for five straight rounds, not touch Floyd Mayweather, and land one. And that could be the end of it. I'm not saying Floyd's a punk or he's got a soft jaw. Broner can hit. Broner can punch, and Broner's got power. So, you know, you match that with one big shot early in the fight, I could see it happening, and I just don't understand or think that anyone else would put that. I don't think Floyd would put that at stake there when you've got, you know, everything in line. It's not with Floyd now. It's not just the zero. It's not just the money. It's his legacy. It's what he means to boxing in his own right and things of that nature. So to him, he's going to calculate every risk. He's going to calculate every penny earned and make sure that if 50 is coming, that it's the right fight for him and it's the right fight for his pockets. I go back to the first loss with Maidana, the only loss of Maidana by Adrian Broner. And after the fight, Floyd Mayweather put the entire loss on Adrian Broner. The fact that he didn't listen to his team of trainers and people in the front and help him pick a match like he did with the Pauly Malignaggi fight, Adrian Broner did, you know, Floyd, you know, denigrated that fact that Adrian took it upon his own self to pick his own fight by himself without the consult of anyone else. By listening to that and hearing what Floyd has to say, Floyd doesn't just go out there and pick someone and that's the end all be all. He's got a team. He knows what he's going to go after. And like I said, it's got to be right for the ring and it's got to be right for the pockets for Floyd Mayweather for him to take that fight. And like you said, unless it's in the $100 million range, and it could be $120-150 million. I honestly think he'd step into the ring with Broner for anything north of 100, but of course that's speculation, and that's if they can even make it up to be a big fight, and that's if even Broner's walking around on the streets to fight. So there's a lot of working pieces with that, and then again, you know, Kell Brook, no one mentions him or tries to fight him because he's serving up L's to everyone, and he'll likely go down undefeated as well.
Right.
It's just one of those things that he's too good. And in this day and age, when you get to pick your fight, no one's going to elect to fight him unless they're forced to. And most of these three-letter championship belts won't make you fight anyone at the end of the day.
Right. And that's really how I feel about the Kell Brook situation. Look, not even his own countrymen, not even Amir Khan wants to fight him. And knowing how much money that will generate, not only in America, but over there in England, that could be like a mega fight. And Americana's like, I don't want no parts of that guy at all. But here's the last thing I have to say about it, and we'll get away from it. Look, if there's big money behind it, and I know this would be a fight that Floyd would regret if he took Adrian Broner, and Broner ended up winning that fight, whether by point or knockout, this is something that Floyd would regret because knowing how much these guys used to get along, knowing how much they were going back and forth verbally, and with him not only taking care of business in front of Theo Payne, him also being the guy of boxing. Like to be honest, Floyd is the guy of boxing. Whether you could throw Deontay Wilder, Tyson Fury, Vladimir Klitschko, and these are just me throwing out heavyweights, Andre Ward, Triple G. Floyd's name, he's supposed to be retired, and they still throw his name out there. Like, so just knowing how much it will fall into the lap of Adrian Broner if he were to get this fight to happen and win the fight, because he'd have to train his tail off. But like I said, I'm proud that Adrian Broner's turning the corner. I think he should be focused on people that are relevant in the sport. I think, if anything, he should get that rematch against Sean Porter, because, to be honest, to me, that was an embarrassing showing. To me, I really feel like every fight that I watch with Adrian Broner, if he can bully these guys, or if he's stronger than the guy, he's going to take these fights. When he fought Porter, he felt Porter's power. He didn't want any problems. Why don't you take that personally and then come for Floyd? That's how I look at that.
Mm-hmm.
That's
I mean, he's really got one. Before Porter, he's got another revenge fight, and I honestly think him and McDonald should just look it up one more time. But, yeah, you're right. He's got other people to worry about. He's got other people to worry about.
That's true, too. I think McDonald would take that fight. I think McDonald would take that fight. And
he's hungry, too.
No,
yeah.
Because because he ain't fighting a while. You know what I'm saying? And shoot, not for nothing. He already got the confidence, man. I laid this dude down twice in a fight. Like, so like, I think there's a couple of fights that AJ could take to be on redemption road before he could be, you know, let me aim at the top. He beat Ashley Theopane by a low blow and then call for Floyd. Like I can see if he brutally beat Theopane, and Theopane was literally Floyd's protege, like walk in and out of stores and stuff. Stop. This is a dude that trains at the Mayweather Boxing Club and trains with Nate Jones, and that's what you get. So, hey, okay. So I'm getting away from that. I'm getting away from it because I don't want to spend too much time on Adrian Broner. I got a lot of things to get into. However, like I said, we haven't been here since Friday. The loss that went down in Golden State, ending their home winning streak up against the Boston Celtics, in which the last five games, or actually six games, that the Celtics have played against the Golden State Warriors, the point total has, I mean, well, the plus-minus situation hasn't been over five. So the Celtics have never lost more than 5 points up against Golden State. So this is a matchup that actually is a problematic situation for Golden State. Not to say that they're going to end up bumping into the Celtics in the NBA Finals, but this is something for the recipe on how to deal with Golden State, especially with them being close enough in Boston the day after my birthday, people, December 11th, they were so close. They went into overtime or double overtime, if I'm not mistaken, up against Golden State, which they ended up losing. And then they brought the battle to the Oracle in Oakland and ended up winning this one. I just want to know how people feel about the situation. And just looking at the situation that Golden State had multiple opportunities to try and tie this game up and couldn't get it done. Your thoughts on this situation with Golden State losing their first home game in April?
Interesting stat I heard about Stephen Curry against the Celtics this year in the first quarter. I believe it's 2-for-11 from the field. For whatever reason, against his team, he can't get it going in the first quarter. That might be a detriment to his team. But to me, the biggest story of this are two shoes, and those are Isaiah Thomas's shoes. The fact that he goes in at halftime, changes to the all-star Kobe's, and lights it up. No, I'm just kidding. It's not really the shoes. Isaiah Thomas told the player, was one of the key factors I felt in the victory. Obviously, what he did on the court in that second half and that third quarter specifically was, for me, it was nice to watch. You know, I'm a little guy, so watching a little guy run around and score on people is always fun for me to watch and do the things that he was doing. To me, however, watching the game, and I was unable to watch the end of the game, the fourth quarter pretty much because of personal reasons, but the following it on my phone, when they're down, I believe it is 10 or 11 there in the fourth quarter with 7 minutes, you know, 6-7 minutes left in the game, there's no worry. I mean, people are worrying, hey, are they going to lose? Are the Warriors going to lose? They're down 10, it's the middle of the fourth. What's going on? When it's 103-101 with about a minute left, I'm still thinking that they got it. It's still going to I think you said it best the other day. It's the same thing that when you're watching Serena lose to the nobody, and I say nobody because I can't remember her name, and you don't believe it until it actually happens, and that's the same thing I feel with the Warriors. So last night I was just watching the thing ticker and in my mind I'm saying, okay, where's the three? Where's the three? Literally, the whole last minute, I'm waiting to see something where it says Steph Curry, three-pointer, where it's about two or three in a row, they get the lead back, they take over, and then, you know, the home field, the home court's preserved, and yada, yada, yada. It never happened last night. I don't know what it was. Again, I didn't specifically see the ending of the game except for highlights, so I didn't catch the full sequences, if the Celtics had figured out something or anything of that nature. But to me, the overwhelming factor is the first quarter, Steph not get it going, and then in the third quarter, Isaiah Thomas being able to let loose and get off, whether, like you said, that it is attributed to the shoes or anything else, you know, mentally or physically, or he just felt better. Or like you said, they took him to double overtime and almost won. They were confident at halftime still. I just think that this is a game that the Celtics are supremely confident now, and they're a team that in the Eastern Conference are something that I would really, really be hesitant to just play in a series. They're a team that is supremely confident in the talent, in the coaching, and everything that they have going on. This is a team that to me flies so under the radar, and from the front office down to the end of the bench are in unison. They are one. They know what they're doing. They know what they want to do, and they know as best as way to get it done. So, and I know I'm probably overhyping the Celtics a lot, but to me, this is a team all year that has just been under the radar and played very well. Lost some tight games, like you said, to the Warriors. There are some other close games they lost. There's some really good teams, and then of course they've also beaten a bunch. So, just the Celtics to me are the highlight of the night. Again, the Warriors. This is nothing that I would sit back and say, whoa, we got to look at what's going on and see what this is. You need to get Steph Curry going in the first quarter, whatever that may be, whatever, if it's lackadaisical, if it's because we're six games from the beginning of the playoffs. I don't know what it is. This team, again, we talk about it all year long. It's an 82-game season. It's long. It's grueling. Can they keep up the intensity that we saw from the first several months? And for the past month and a half, we have thought, yes, they can keep it going. We're getting into April now. We're getting into these times. That's the one thing I would look to for these Warriors. Can the intensity, can the mentality stay up? We know the skill is going to be there. The physicality is going to be there. But can mentally this team stay in it for the long haul through April into championship week and things of that nature? That's one of those things that I'm going to be looking for from the Warriors, especially over these last six games. We all know it's five to break, you know, the magic number is five, and you win five of the last six, they broke the record. We will see how intent they are in breaking the record. We will also see, to me, how ready they are for the playoffs. I will take great, you know, consideration to these fourth quarters, these next six fourth quarters, in these next six games to see what these Warriors look like. Because I think this could, I'm not saying it is, but it could lead down a terrible road for them if they catch another two or three L's. If they don't you know, make up the fourth quarter like they couldn't against the Celtics and don't take that lead back like we've seen them do time and time, what is it, 38, 39 times all year since, you know, the beginning of the year, and then even in the last year, we've seen them come back at the end at home. And let's just see if that's something that lingers or if this was a one-game thing. To me, I think it's one game. I think the Warriors are fine. The Celtics are on the come-up. This is everything to do about the Celtics and little to do about the Warriors.
And which, looking at everything that's going on in the Eastern Conference, as of last night, the Charlotte Hornets pushed. So the Hornets went from sixth to third. And we talked about this, how tight it is in the Eastern Conference right now, 3-6, not a game, right? So the Hornets actually are in third place, notched up with Atlanta, and I think it's more or less because of how they got the divisional purposes is where Charlotte has the edge, in which Boston and Miami are half a game back. Now, Boston just knocked off the Golden State Warriors. I think this could be an adrenaline shot or I hate to use it like this, PED situation or HGH for their mentality moving forward on them playing a lot of these teams for the last, what, I think six games left in the season. If they could run off the last six, they could actually end up moving up to fourth or better and getting home court advantage in this scenario. So I think that this is a big game for Boston. Looking at the Golden State Warriors, it don't matter if they lose two or three games out of the last six games that they have left in their schedule. They're on pace to at least win 70 games this season. 70 and 71, 72, 73, 74, if they run the table, so on and so forth. Like, I don't find this as a failure. I just find this as a situation, like, at this point in time where they're playing stellar basketball at home. And knowing Boston is a team that they have a problem with, they have to basically, hold them down to basically build some type of morale, if you will. And for what they did with Isaiah Thomas, he didn't score any points in the first half for him to actually, you know, stake claim to the Kobe Bryant shoes that he put on and ended up putting up 22 points and a half and actually throws some of that shade at where that defense at one point. This is the number one ranked defense in the league right now. And I think that's what a lot of teams get caught up doing. Once they see a lead by Golden State, let's just say Golden State goes up five, it's automatically, you know, programmed in a lot of these players' mind or teams' mind, shoot the three. Shoot a three. They miss the three, Steph come down or Clay come down, hit a three, they're down eight, damn near 10, game over, because you already in an uphill battle trying to shoot with guys that all they want to do is shoot the ball. So people just play possession basketball, steer the course, and that's the same words that Isaiah Thomas was using, steer the course. You can be successful. All you got to do is put the ball in the goal. You don't have to shoot for the star. You don't have to knock down three. Listen, Steph Curry is on pace to hit 400 threes this season. So that is letting you know that his mindset is to shoot a three ball. I would say to stay close to him to make sure that he doesn't shoot it. I'd rather watch him drive. And of course, he's going to hit floaters. Of course, he's going to hit layups. He might find a guy to get the dish on and so forth. I'd rather that. I don't want him to get used to finding that rim. Like I'd rather him find a shot late and it be too late. And Boston did what they needed to do up until this point. But, you know, anything else away from this situation, before we get away from the Celtics-Warriors melee on Friday evening?
The only thing for the Warriors that I'll say this is, these next six games, the way I find them crucial, Portland, Minnesota, San Antonio, Memphis. That's a pretty intense stretch for six games for any team. I know the Warriors are the greatest team since sliced bread, although Scottie Pippen would beg to differ on that. But I really do think that these six games to me, and again, I'm not looking at the entirety of the game, the fourth quarters to me, again, these next six fourth quarters to me would define the Warriors and what I can expect from them from the playoffs. Again, if they're up 10 or 15 in the fourth quarter, I don't know if I can put too much into that. But if they're in a battle like they were again, and we see this where they're coming up short time and time again, I will look into that. I will see something into that. Again, one time, like you said, it doesn't mean much more than like the Celtics, more than it has to do with the Celtics being trying to push in that East. But I really am looking forward to these next six games for the Warriors and seeing, again, if they're up, you know, big in the end of the third and the fourth quarter, it might be a much ado about nothing and they ride off into the sunset with 73. But if they're tight games, like I expect them to be in those four against the Grizzlies and the Spurs, I think maybe we could have some questions as to what the Warriors really have up against them in these playoffs. But other than that, I think the Celtics are the team to watch.
And they have the Trailblazers today. They also play San Antonio twice, too, in which I think they only have room to lose two games that at least tie the record because they have eight losses. So if they lose two more games, they tie it. If they lose three, they fall to 71. Excuse me, I said 69. 71. Now, I'm going to give you one more dish before we get into the meat and potatoes and everything, and that is, in principle, the San Francisco 49ers and the Broncos have somebody on the move. Now, it was Vernon Davis just last season. The guy that was throwing them passes could potentially land in Colorado with the Denver Broncos. Now, I'm not even going to be too negative about it, but I am. I think this is better than having Mark Sanchez run the show while Peyton retired and Brock Osweiler is down in Houston. Your thoughts on this scenario? Kaepernick potentially in Denver with the Super Bowl winning Broncos.
Okay, before we get into the X's and O's, let's get into the logistics of this. The separation now is $4.2 or $4.9 million that the 49ers are unwilling to pay in the contract of Colin Kaepernick. The problem with this whole thing to me is the Broncos from the get-go have said they're not paying Colin that much money. You messed up by letting it roll now into April 3rd. He's fully guaranteed for that 11.9 or whatever it is. The problem with that is Denver and John Elway have said, we're not paying him that, we're not doing this. And of course, obviously, Colin's not going to restructure and to take less money. You know, the only smart one I see in all of this is Colin Kaepernick. To be honest, I don't even know if this deal gets done. The Niners are unwilling to pay that $4.9 million, and the Broncos are unwilling to, you know, pay him the entirety of his salary that's fully guaranteed now that, that it's April 3rd going into next year. So, again, the logistics may hold this up, but the X's and O's of it, if I'm Chip Kelly, I'm screaming at my front office. I finally get to a place where my quarterback, whether or not is one of the greatest passers or whether or not, you know, he's intellectually sound at reading defenses, is tailor-made to the offense I want to run. Now, we can all sit here and argue about who could be better suited or better fit for a Chip Kelly offense, but if we're going to choose between Blaine Gabbert or Mr. Colin Kaepernick to run a Chip Kelly offense, I think the poll would be unanimous that it's Colin Kaepernick. So if I'm Chip Kelly, I'm extremely pissed off right now, and I have no idea what the heck is going on with my front office. Now, if I'm Denver, again, they don't know in their front office what they're doing. Again, we're supposed to hear about John Elway and the greatest GM he's supposed to be, and we all know the greatest signing he ever did was signing Peyton Manning. To me, having Mark Sanchez and Colin Kaepernick on your roster and having to choose, we all know the analogy: put crap in one and crap in the other. Pick which one smells least worse. I think that's the problem that Denver fans will be facing, you know, picking their quarterback when it comes to next year. This is an offense that, again, he will need to read defenses. He's not going to be able to do a one-read option type of style where he reads one player, sees what's going on, either makes one pass or takes off. This is one of those things that I think is extremely bad for Colin Kaepernick as the player, going to a Gary Kubiak system that we all know takes time. It takes tons and tons of time for an intellectual quarterback to grasp and understand. Now you want to bring in Colin Kaepernick, who can't get past his first read in an offense, and you want him to make multiple decisions. I'm just not feeling it. So to me, all around, it's a big humble jumble mess. The only person that really is going to make out like a bandit in this is Colin. Now that it's past April 1st and it's April 3rd, he's fully guaranteed. He doesn't have to budge a centimeter to go anywhere. He can sit there and collect his check, and that's all there is to it. The thing that, like I said, that really would upset me is if I were Chip Kelly, because we have a guy who whatever you want to say about Colin, knows the NFL, knows how it feels to play in NFL games, whether it be playoffs, NFC championships. We all forget this guy played in the Super Bowl sometimes, about crappy he's played the last couple of years. But this is a guy who has played in big-time situations, played in big-time games. He's played in regular season games with a good team around him, albeit he knows the feeling. You build around Colin, especially with a Chip Kelly offense. Whether or not we agree it's going to work, like I said, right now, Chip Kelly and Colin Kaepernick, that's your best options if you're San Francisco. You're not going to get a rookie to come in here and do anything, and there's really nobody on the market now that RG3 is off that you can take. So, to me, this is all around, you know, butt fumble. I hate to bring Mark Sanchez, but that's really what it seems like. It's just a horrible, horrible play out of events. That only Colin Kaepernick's pockets are going to be the only thing that really makes out.
Right, and I think this is what they are concerned about, if they can actually get the deal worked out financially. They're saying that it's actually come to a halt until they can get these numbers right, which I'm watching closely, because hopefully Denver makes the right move. And all of the things that have been said about Kaepernick, you know, are fair for the past couple of seasons, but to me, and this is just me personally, analytically, I could break it down and everything, I think the better choice is to try and get Kaepernick there before I go with Mark Sanchez after winning a Super Bowl and thinking that he's going to, one, put us back at the top of the AFC West, and two, look at our goal again and trying to repeat. I mean, are you content? Are you settling with winning the Super Bowl and that's that? That you could just bring any quarterback there? Mark Sanchez was sitting on the bench behind Sam Bradford. If Sam Bradford wasn't injured, he wouldn't have seen any time. You're getting a backup in Mark Sanchez, where his last bit of relevancy came, what, 2010-2011 season. So, you know, Kaepernick, he dealt with his bumps and bruises. He's lost players. A lot of people walked out of that door, including his coach, who basically helped strengthen him, his mind and his efforts out there on the field, too. I think he can learn a bit being in Denver, whether being inspired within the system, being around John Elway, being around some unique players in that core, and DT, and also Emmanuel Sanders. It can help. It can help. But I think that'll be the better move, if you will. But right now they're stuck with Sanchez until they can actually come up with an agreement. So I think both sides, because Kaepernick, to me, I wouldn't want him if I were him, I wouldn't want to stick around San Francisco with potentially Anquan Boldin maybe leaving. You already watched Crabtree go. You already watched Vernon Davis go. So it's just going to be you and Torrey Smith and a bunch of guys trying to figure out the system that hasn't really worked since he's gotten into the NFL, being with Chip Kelly. So that is the one thing that I am looking at with Kaepernick in San Francisco and also for Denver. Both of them have intriguing situations going into the 2016-2017 season. Okay. Now, I don't know where to go with this. Like, cause now I got a lot of stuff in my lap, especially with opening day here. But I do want to talk about the national championship situation before I get into the games that we have taking place. We have four matchups for opening day, and I don't want to, you know, overlook that situation. I definitely want to at least get winners and who would win their first game out of the gate. But for City, the Final Four is here, and now the national championship is set as of Monday. In the first game, the Villanova Wildcats take on the Oklahoma Sooners, right? And I was on air on Friday talking junk about this matchup because I was like, if Oklahoma wins, I'm going to have a whole lot to say to the public, media, so on and so forth. I want people to hear me if Oklahoma is to be successful. And I don't want to talk bad about Oklahoma as the team. I want to talk bad about Oklahoma and the university. But in which, the conference that I respect, love, and admire, being the Big East, the Villanova Wildcats, I don't even know how to put this. I don't. I'm going to try and be nice for a city. But bamboozled, beat the crap out of, smacked around. I don't know how to put this lightly. Now, at one point, they had this being Oklahoma. Oklahoma had this as low as 9. As low as 9 points. They had this at 9 points. They ended up losing this game by 44 points. 44 points. Now, one, Jay Wright, I think being bred out of the Big East, you seeing a lot of big game players, so on and so forth, and I can speak personally on it. I'm not. I'm going to just talk analytically. But I'm seeing a lot of different use of big game players and having to slow these guys down. I think they were prepared for Buddy Hield, especially with them seeing him earlier this season and knowing what he's been doing up until this point. They held Buddy Hield to single-digit points. Single-digit. They held him to 9, where he hit 1-3. So basically 6 points left in the game. I don't care if he was at the free throw line. He had 3 layups or what. They put up 90-plus on you guys. I mean, Villanova is ready to get to that national championship and prove that they can do what they did just 30 years ago against my doggone Georgetown Hoyas. I'm mad that almost everything that I see with either North Carolina or Villanova, it has something to do with Georgetown. It's like they know it must be me or something. Like, it got to be me around the sport or something. So they talking Georgetown, this Georgetown, that stop. So that's one. Now two, I don't even know where to look at or who was the guy for them. It could be Hart. It could be playing the paint with Ochefu. The way these guys defended around the perimeter made it real tough for guys like Buddy to get off and knock shots down. Your thoughts with two number two seeds going at it, and one did not look like a number two seed at all in Oklahoma. Your thoughts on Villanova advancing to the national championship?
Wow. To me, it was unexpected. I really wasn't a Villanova supporter or fan of the team when it comes to this bracket or the tournament. I think I had them making them to possibly the Elite Eight in most of mine, but that was about it. I do have to commend Villanova for what happened. I was astonished, to be honest. At the end of the first, when it's 42-28, I just could not believe it. I was okay. You know, this is something that they can come back from, but Yields can, you know, knock some shots down to begin the second period, and we could see what's going on. We can get, or not we as in Oklahoma, but we can see as a community, see what's going on in this game, and see that Buddy Hield is back in the form, and he's shooting right, and just never happened. Team as a total, I think it was 19 for 60. You can't win a game like that. We all know that. You know, 30% from the field, you turn the ball over 17 times, you're out-rebounded. You just totally got dominated the entire game by a Villanova team. That was just very, very, to me, underestimated. I didn't think that there would be much of an exciting game, but the way that they came out, they took over, and they just dominated from start to go. Like you said, it was down to 9 there, and I thought maybe something could happen, and then it just sprouted up from there. And then of course, in that second period, it never stopped. I mean, 50. I think they got blown out. Was it 30 points? Yeah, 53-23 in that second period there, or the second half, however you want to say it. That's just pure domination by a team going up against who arguably some have as the best player in college football, Buddy Hield. You know, talk about Ben Simmons, talk about I'm scratching my head right now, but, you know, you can talk about those other two guys, but right now you can argue that Buddy Hield is the best player in the NBA or in the NCAA. So this is astonishing to me, and I think to most of the public, not to Villanova and their fan base, obviously, they wanted a victory, but I just didn't expect a 44-point thump, and to see it just unfold, it was just, you know, like I said, wow and astonishing. I don't know if this is something that haunts, you know, Oklahoma in the organization the school or this team. Again, you know more in depth, I think, more about the draft than I do. I don't know if Buddy Hield's going to declare or not, or, you know, how that works. But if he's going to stay around, because I think this team, obviously, you get more time and you could see what happened. You made it to the Final Four next year. You possibly could, you know, win the whole thing. So other than that, though, this is a team that I want to see, you know, maybe build off of this. But, of course, we all know what may happen. But I just don't understand what happened to Buddy. Again, this was a guy who I think he was first or second next to Steph Curry on the all-time NCAA scoring list. He was averaging, 30 points a game, I believe, before the Oklahoma game, so before the Villanova game. So I just don't I don't know. That's pretty much what it comes down to. It's an astonishing loss for me by Oklahoma.
At one point, in that second half, okay, let me just say it like this. Oh, no, I'm going to say it this how it was. At one point in the second half, the Villanova Wildcats went on a 25-0 run. People, I don't know if y'all understand what I'm talking about here. They scored 25 straight points, and Oklahoma didn't hit a free throw, a layup, a three-point shot, a technical foul. Like, nothing was going in that cup for Oklahoma at all. Here goes icing on the cake. And where you do have to make up the ground and try and win the game in the second half, because that is the initial situation what you have to do. Villanova missed 5 shots the entire second half. 5. 20 minutes, they only missed 5. You mean every 4 minutes, they missed 1 shot. They stop it. Stop it. I don't know what Jay Wright did. I don't know if he played Rocky music for them, if he played the tape from 85 when they beat Georgetown and told them 70% shooting wins championship, just look at this, and they wanted to shoot 70% or better. They shot better than 70% on the game. Like, I don't know what they were doing or what blueprint they came up with. But the way that they smacked Oklahoma around, one, Lon Kruger came out with a statement before the game. He said he's going to bleed from his socks to win this game. Well, your ankles are cut off or something. I don't know, because that was a bludgeoning. And two, a 25-0 run, like, what defensive situations could they have come up with, like pressing these guys or loading up the paint? Because everything was working for Villanova, to say the least, in which you had guys that, you know, are playing better within Jay Wright's system. And, again, I think Hart being the guy, and this is going to be tough for the upcoming team, which in the matchup that we're going to talk about, for a lot of these teams to actually build off of, because you don't know who's going to be the guy to try and slow down or stop for Villanova, because they get efforts all across the board. They team rebound. They play good team defense on the perimeter, make it difficult for guys to get shots off. Buddy Hill was 1-for-8 from three, like I said. And I think a lot of the Oklahoma Sooners, they build off of seeing Buddy get going. Once Buddy gets going, I think the rest of the team falls into play and makes it tougher on the team, on teams that they're going up against. Once Buddy was ice cold, I think the rest of the team was in a disarray or trying their hardest to try and get the ball scored, and it did not work in their favor. But for them to damn near lose by close to 50 points in a national – in a national semi, let me just say it like that. I'm going to say a national championship, but in a national semi, speaks a lot about both teams. If Oklahoma – will ever be ready to get back here, because Buddy's going back to the league. Buddy's going to the league. They won't have another shooter to come through that door to help them. They don't got a Blake Griffin coming back to save them. And Lon Kruger, I wonder how your recruiting goes in this offseason to try and get somebody that's built to shoulder the load down in Oklahoma. And I was going to go off of, talking about what happened last year in the, university, well, Oklahoma University with that, that fraternity that was talking junk about minorities, so on and so forth. And if Buddy Hill were to be successful, how they were basically riding him to a national championship. And I wanted Oklahoma to be successful just for that reason, because I was going to just blow up on that situation where they try to sweep it under the rug. And it is not to be forgotten, because it's a year later, in which, people got expelled and kicked out of school and they had to close the chapter up. But it's tough to see, guys like Buddy Hill, and just like you said, the fans were behind them to get this far. We got to come together. That is the one thing that I throw out there. Anything else in front of us before we get away from it?
Just real quickly on Villanova, I can't remember, and maybe you do. We were talking about this when the tournament started. The person said, look out for the team with the least inexperience. I mean, the least freshmen. This team has three freshmen on its team, one sophomore. Everyone else is a junior or senior. And we're talking about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 seniors on this team. To me, this is a team that's scary. It's experienced. And like you said, they're hungry. So, I can't remember who said it, but I had big ups to them, because this is a team that, like I said, it was unexpected, and you hit it right on the head. There's not just one guy. This is a team, and I think that's even scarier.
Okay, so the next matchup I want to talk about is the way that a lot of people figured this would end up panning out. I really wish Mikey D would come around here and talk about Syracuse now. And I've been trying to plug to him all morning that I'm trying to sit on this Syracuse situation so you can talk about the team, and he's not trying to mess with me, because this is how people get. Like I tell Nacho all the time. Ever since Nacho came, I've had the slogan go on for a while, but I've been drilling home for a while. Like, I have to be here. Some people choose to be here. You know what I'm saying? So while Syracuse is winning, they come here talking about Detroit Lions and this, that, or the third. Now that their team is out, they don't want to come and eat dishes. But in which they put forth an interesting matchup up against North Carolina before. It was, basically runaway situation for the University of North Carolina Tar Heels, winning this matchup by 17 points, and actually doing as best as they could without Bryce, because early Bryce was actually in foul trouble. They had him on the bench, being Bryce Johnson, and Syracuse actually kept it interesting. But once everything came to settled down for North Carolina, they took care of business and throttled them. And just like I said, you're going to have to – well, the name of the game is outscoring, but you're going to really have to go out there and put up a 80-plus point game to knock off North Carolina, because they are averaging this on a game-by-game basis, in which I think Villanova can actually slow them up and score that ball the same clip too. So this actually sets up for a very good national championship. But North Carolina – taking care of Syracuse and potentially watching this be one of, if they do go that route, watching this be potentially Jim Boeheim's last coaching situation, where he's actually clued that he may come back next season. He didn't want to talk about retirement, but with everything that they may be facing legally, well, would be in North Carolina. Syracuse has already gone through their situation. But your thoughts on Syracuse coming, well, losing big up against North Carolina?
It was expected. I didn't really have Syracuse pass the second round in most of my brackets. So I just, to me, it was a storybook run for the Syracuse Orange, and they were going as far as you know, the light and their bright shining star would go. It went out in the Final Four. You know, it is what it is. They met a superior team, a better team, and of course they were beating those teams up until this point. To me, North Carolina just did what they were supposed to do. And Syracuse did what they were supposed to do, which was lose and lose big. So, to me, there was no unexpected things. And North Carolina didn't wow me, and it didn't, you know, impress me so much. It was something that they were supposed to do. Again, winning is winning. I've never taken anything away from a team that wins, especially a team that's going to a national championship or a championship of any kind. They did what they were supposed to do. Now it's time to go to the national championship and play a team that's up to your caliber and beat them. But, you know, the game itself wasn't a surprise, and it wasn't, to me, a big shocker or anything like that. The shocker to me was that the Syracuse were still in the tournament. Other than that, the Tar Heels did exactly what they were supposed to do and took care of a lower enchelon team that shouldn't have even been there.
Now, looking at the setup for this matchup for the national championship with Villanova and North Carolina going at it for Monday night, and I can tell you the wrap-up is going to be pretty entertaining before the game. But I don't even know how to look at this because both of these teams rebound well. Both of these teams play defense. Both of these teams score, in which Villanova's been shooting the ball at 70%. They've been shooting the ball at 70%. It's like North Carolina's been playing great ball. How do they stop that? How do you stop a 70% shooting team from the field? I mean, they're doing everything right. And the one thing that North Carolina hasn't been doing is shooting the ball well from the perimeter, and that's what Villanova's been wanting to do, is getting guys to shoot bad shots from the perimeter. So they're going to have to draw their horses back and go back to the paint and worry about guys like Meeks and Johnson to try and contain the beast that it is right now, being North Carolina Tar Heels. How do we look forward to this game coming up tomorrow?
I'm excited. To me, I look forward to, like you said, two teams that one that's scoring 80 points a game and one that's shooting 70%. I'm excited. This is a game where we're going to have to see one defense shut down the other, and that's pretty much it. I think both these teams can light the scoreboard and put up a big number. We saw 91 from Villanova their last game, and like you said, we've been seeing 80 points consistently from North Carolina. So in this college game, I think this is going to be a high-scoring, you know, edge of your seat type of game for both schools, both school fan bases, and I'm actually excited for this. I wasn't too thrilled, you know, after a few of my teams gotten taken out in the brackets, like I'm sure everyone else. But for national championships, for team styles, and like we said, styles mix fights, these are two teams that have almost not the same style, but want to do the same thing, which is put up the most points, and they can't. Obviously, you want to put up more points, but they want to put up a lot. Whether or not they're beating you by 10 or beating you by 44, they want to put up as many as possible, and both teams can do that. So I think the defenses are going to we're going to have to see exactly who steps up on defense and who can shut someone down. Again, with Villanova, there is a chance. And with Villanova, there is no one guy that if you lock down a Buddy Hield type player, a Ben Simmons type player, that you lock him down, and most often not the team shut down. Villanova is a team, five guys, you know, five guys on the floor, nine on the bench, and they're ready to get after this. So I think this is, to me, going to be an entertaining game, and almost was going to let away who I was going to pick there, but I guess we'll wait for tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
But it's going to be a very, very interesting game. And I'm man, whew, the score, you know, whoever, you know, at the end of the bracket, you put the score in, you better have guessed a really high number, 80s, 90s, even possibly 100, because I think they're just going to light the scoreboard, and whoever just gets the ball last might be the winner. I'm not expecting much from either defense, but this is going to be a lights out event. You know, I'm just excited. I love high scoring basketball games. I know a lot of people love defenses, whatever sport it is, but to me, in basketball, I just love watching guys go down and buckets all day. poor defense to me sometimes doesn't matter as long as I'm seeing buckets in this game. So I'm going to be excited to watch it, I'm just really excited. I didn't think I was going to be as excited for the national championship game, but knowing that, you know, who the teams are and what we can expect from both, I'm pretty excited for.
Okay. Before I get into the, you know, MLB opening day, you start getting winners, so on and so forth, one more topic that I know that you hit on outside of Sports City, where I want to address it here in the kitchen and kind of get you to open your lungs on the situation. Daniel Cormier, injured, out for the fight April 23rd, which is coming up pretty soon, up against John Bones Jones. Now, these two already have an interesting situation going on. John Bones Jones getting in trouble with the law, so on and so forth, but now you got Daniel Cormier talking about he's going to die to win this fight and then end up getting hurt or injured outside of this fight. Your thoughts on everything, I mean everything across the board, whether it's John Jones in this situation, whether it's Daniel Cormier, and a lot of people think that he's chickening out, which I'm not going to lie, people, I feel like this is a chicken situation. Like, I truly do. But your thoughts before I do end up jumping the gun. I don't want to persuade you in any way.
To me, oh, my goodness, I'm just not a fan of this. You can't, if you're Daniel Cormier, keep your damn mouth shut. You can't come out, talk the mess you talk, get slept around and get beat. Come out again now that the guy's gone and suspended or whatever. He was gone for a while. Jones was gone. You were handed an easy fight. You won the fight. You know, now you want to talk crap again to the guy that beat you. And then now you're injured, but you'll die in a ring. You know what? You know, I didn't have very much respect for Daniel Cormier. I did like him. A while ago, I thought maybe he could change the game of the MMA with the ground style and the ground and pound that he was displaying, and it just, I thought, you know, more highly of him than I should have at the time. Now he's just the runner of the mouth who is pretty good, but will never be an elite champion. And when you go up and against an elite champion like John Bones Jones, and we could take the outside the ring stuff and everything that goes along with that, but inside that ring, there are very few talents like John Bones Jones, Anderson Silva, GSP. There are names that you can just say that you know, regardless of what's going on, they're probably going to win the fight. Those guys are just elite fighters. They're great, and at the time of their height, no one could beat them. No one. And there's a couple other names you can throw in there too, but that is not Daniel Cormier. And the fact of the matter is the guy is, you know, taking an easy way out. Again, I'm never going to sit there and talk about another man's injury when I am not a professional fighter. I've had one or two bones broken, you know, bad in my life, so I don't know the pain that he's going through. Again, like people say, I wish there was a machine that we could put our hands in and then it can simulate the amount of pain that someone else is feeling in an injury or sustaining in that time of pain into the way that they feel it. Because right now, obviously, I would like to speculate that the guy is faking an injury. I would like to speculate that the guy has taken a wrong turn of an ankle or a wrong fall or a wrong punch and has turned it into something more than it could have been. You could have shaken it off, got back in the ring the next day and kept fighting. I really want to say those things, but I don't know the amount of pain personally that man is in, but it would not what would be the – what would be – I don't know. It would not shock me. It would not wow me. It would not astonish me at how somehow John Bones Jones was suspended from action and now Cormier's okay. Or John Bones Jones loses and he's no longer the number one contender, then Cormier is ready and raring to fight. It would not shock me at all. So to be honest, it's a load of horse crap. I just don't buy it. I really don't personally don't think that the guy really wants to fight John Jones, and he knows what he's doing. And John Jones, he knows that he's gonna come in and take that belt and win and become champion again and then dominate. It's just what's gonna happen. The kid's still young in John Jones, and he's still a great fighter. Now get the personal life in order, and we'll see. But Daniel Cormier is just he's ridiculous. And the fact of the matter is you're just not good enough, and now you want to use this as an excuse. So I'm totally not a fan of it. And before we get into that, I mean, potatoes, the rematch has been set for Conor McGregor and Nate Diaz for UFC 200. That's not the interesting part. The interesting part is on the undercard, not the undercard, but on the card itself is a fight between Frankie Edgar and Jose Aldo. That fight will have an interim belt in the middle of it. That interim belt is for the featherweight title. We could see Conor McGregor take two L's, still have a championship, and dominate a weight class that we know he dominates. And then, like I said, you got Frankie Edgar and Jose Aldo, two really good, intense fighters who are fighting for an interim championship just to get punched out by a guy who's coming off possibly a second loss. I'm not saying he's going to lose, but when you jump up to a weight class that we all know you can't handle, it's going to be kind of something to see. But, you know, that card in and of itself, 200 and 197. 197 got a lot more interesting in the fact that we're going to have to see possibly a Rumble Jones rematch and an interim belt for that title while Cormier recovers from injury. This is going to be super interesting in these next two. Well, it'd be, you know, 197, and they're going to have a 198, 199, and 200 in July. 200 and 197, I got my eye on, because if Rumble goes in there and takes care of business, or John Jones goes in there and takes care of business, I want to see what Cormier has to do about it, because if he's not ready by 198 or 99, 200 will be the main eventer. It'll be a, you know, probably a three main eventer going on over there, and it's just going to be interesting, very, very interesting. Again, Cormier, you're losing that title, to be honest, no matter who you fight. But of course, he's going to lose it to John Jones. I'm just so interested in what's going through Dana White's head. Again, all of his cash cows have taken big losses. Some of them can't stay out of trouble. And he's trying to make things go together and make things work. First of all, you don't put a 145 at most fighter against the 170 guy who just choked him out again. You don't do that. You don't listen to Conor McGregor and him screaming that he wants redemption. You don't do that. If you do that, you make Diaz come down to Conor's weight class. Again, that's a huge mistake for Conor. That's a huge mistake for Dana White. But again, Dana, I don't know what you're doing. Now you're putting Edgar and Aldo on the main stage, you know, on 200. Now, if they lose, whoever loses, that fight's pretty much gone from your main picture. You can't, especially if it's Aldo, you can't have Aldo losing to Conor, then losing to Edgar, and expect the guy who's held the cash cow for the featherweight to come back and be liked or accepted by the enormous fans, the non-Aldo fans that liked him when he was running his reign. And then you got an Edgar who's got multiple losses, and you got it's just, what are you thinking, Dana White? I don't know if it's, you know, trying to salvage what you've got going on and trying to make it work, but what you've done in the last pay-per-view and tried to make up for it in the subsequent 197 and 200 pay-per-views, I'm not a fan. Of course, these fights are going to be interesting. I will stream every one of them and not have to pay a penny. But they're going to be one. I'm just not thrilled about what the possible outcomes could happen. We could have no names or quite no bodies as champions around 200 and 201, and we could possibly see the downfall of the UFC by the end of this year as it pertains to the fan base leaving because there are no big names in the UFC anymore that carry any weight with undefeated streaks or championship undefeated streaks.
Okay. In which that fight you said about Aldo and Edgar, Frankie has been calling out Conor left and right, which I don't think Frankie wants a part of Conor. I think Conor beat the brakes off of Frank. As much as I like Frank, I don't think he wants that problem. And two, the Cormier situation, the fight that he got it off of was against my boy Rumble, in which he basically tired Rumble out because Rumble actually ended up getting a good shot off and you know, didn't end up sealing the deal and ended up getting, you know, submission hold, if you will, in that bout. I do wonder how this does end up panning out for, you know, John Jones and seeing if they do set up a fight with him and Anthony, if these guys do get to fight, or if they just, you know, hang on to the horse and let this fight go down with all the anticipation behind it. But with all of the junk, the pressers that they've been having, the, you know, the one-on-one situation that they've been going back and forth on, it's like you got to see these guys go at it. Like, you know, there's no other way that you want to see this set up, especially with Cormier, while he was out of the league, called out John Jones and trying to see this go down. And plus, he didn't beat John for the belt. John basically beat himself for it. So that's another thing in itself also. So a lot of different scenarios painted in that picture. I do agree with you. It depends on where this fight is going to be set at for the Nate Diaz and Conor McGregor fight. If they make Nate have to lose weight again, if Nate is going to have to, you know, fight this at whatever weight he'd like to be at, if it's going to be at 170 again or he could be 175, which I doubt. I don't think they'll put him in that situation. But you have a lot of people in the UFC and MMA situation that are actually banking on Conor winning this fight. So that is one thing that I'm throwing out there, that a lot of people think that Conor can be successful in his matchup, especially in the first fight. He opened up a cut on Nate, but Nate was, I think, just too overwhelming for Conor, and I wonder if that actually plays a part in this fight coming up again.
Yeah, and you know, real quickly, and we'll get away from it if you want. The thing with Conor and Nate is, again, from what I've understood, what I've read, the officiated reports from a couple of the guys in the UFC website is at 170 again. That is to protect anything that Conor McGregor wants to put in the featherweight or the weight class above it, you know, range. I think it's more or less this right here is Dana White giving in to Conor McGregor's constant, I need to make up for this, and I really do think this is Conor McGregor in the ear of Dana day in and day out on his phone, day in and day out, begging and pleading for a rematch to make up for the extreme, you know, S-talking that he did prior to the fight and then getting choked out. The only reason I see it being 170 is Conor is at that now. He stays at that. He just gets it in the leaner shape, and he works on it. So I think, you know, for Conor, this is a bad mistake for your record, most likely, and for your in-fighting ability. To me, jumping weight classes is never a good thing, especially that much joint going up and then throwing it back down again when you got to fight. You know, the interim title probably within the next one or two pay-per-views being, you know, the big ones, 201, 202. So to me, it really boggles my mind. Again, Conor and Nate Diaz, what was it? I never understood it. It's two guys that would, under any circumstances in any other professional sport like this, would have never seen each other. They're 20-pound weight different class, you know, 20 pounds away from each other. Neither of these fighters on a regular kid or whatever you want to call it in boxing or anywhere else would have jumped down or jumped up the way Connor did, or the way Nate Diaz was expected to do but couldn't. You know, I just don't see it. So these two guys, or where the beef came from, where everything came from, I don't understand. You know, it was kind of made up and all that other stuff. So it's just to me, it really just those two guys are just, I don't understand it. You know, you're playing. I know with Nate Diaz, I understand it. He wants to pad the pockets. He's got nowhere to go, but mediocre. I mean, to me, he's just a mediocre fighter. He's not anything special or to behold. He's lengthy, and he's 20 pounds bigger than the guy he's fighting. I don't know anyone who's going to lose many fights going up against the guy they're bigger and longer than. I just don't know that. So, to me, the fight, it's ill-advised on Connor's part, and it's ill-advised on Dana White's part. I would have loved to have seen Aldo McGregor, too, at 200, and let that be for whatever, go off into the wind, let them handle it on their personal time in a gym, and let them get 3 5-minute rounds to themselves. Because to me, it makes no sense to put those two in another fight for either of their careers. You're making Conor McGregor prove to the world that he's better than this mediocre fighter that really hasn't done much his entire career at all. And now this is your cash cow, and you're making him fight a guy because he talked too much. I just don't. I don't agree with that whole standpoint. But the fight again, I'm just not thrilled about it. You know, you're bigger, you're longer. You're probably going to choke him out or put him in something again. He's just going to probably beat Connor, and we're going to see a guy take two L's, keep at his belt, and then fight for it and beat someone up that he's already beaten. I'm just not really convinced about it.
Okay, so as we near the end of the show, I do want to get your thoughts on the four games for the opening day, in which we start out out the gate with St. Louis going up against their division rival and foe, the Pittsburgh Pirates. Also, following that game, the Cubs play the Angels in an interleague game to start the season, following that up with the Blue Jays and the Rays, and the World Series, you know, rematch, if you will, one-game scenario. New York, the Mets, are going into Kansas City in another interleague game to start the season off while they raise the championship banner, so on and so forth. Your thoughts on these four matchups and games, who do you like and why?
The Cardinals-Pirates game, I'm pretty interested in. Of course, you get division rivals starting it off. And, of course, just real quick, I'll run through who I feel on this one. I just feel that the Cardinals will get it. I know McCutchen and them boys are hungry, and we've seen the commercials and everything. I just feel this is the opening day. I know it's in Pittsburgh. I just think St. Louis, shows the division. They're ready to come for another championship. The Cubs-Angels game, if I'm not mistaken, though, I think that it's a spring training game. So I'm not going to, what I'm reading here is a spring training game. So I really don't know too much about the players on the spring training rosters and that nature. On the Blue Jays and the Rays, that game, again, to me, with Toronto, I don't know what they're – what exactly we're going to see from them. Is this the team we're going to get from the beginning of the year last year or the end of the year last year? So to me, I'm not too keen on the AL teams in baseball. So if I'm going to flip a coin, I'll go with the Rays. They're at home and it's opening day. But if I'm not mistaken, I do believe Toronto does have a better roster. I just don't know too well about those teams. But with the matchup that I'm sure everyone, that I'm actually interested in, and I don't know too much about baseball, is the World Series rematch with the Mets and the Royals. I'm definitely for the Mets. I think the Mets are pretty PO'd the way they handled the World Series, the way they handled themselves. And I think that this is a game where the Mets want to come out and say, we are going to do this. This wasn't a one-year thing. We are building for a future, and this is what we intend to do: is beat top enchilada teams like World Series champions, and get victories and do things of that nature. So, to me, the Mets. So, out of the three that are opening day games today, I'll take the Cardinals, the Rays, and the Mets, two of which are on the road, which I know probably isn't very, very, you know, a popular opinion, but you know, that's how I'll take it.
Okay, and in which I agree with you with the Cardinals. I think with them having a bad output in the postseason, they won 100 games last year and fell short getting to a World Series situation. I think spelled all too much of them trying to bounce back and get back to the pinnacle of Major League Baseball. So I think they come out the gate smoking hot up against a Pittsburgh team who actually didn't have a bad season themselves, winning over 95 games as well. I don't believe in Tampa right now. As much as I am a Longoria fan, I respect them on a baseball diamond. I think Toronto has too much, and knowing that they had a good season going on last year too, and knowing that this is a division game too, both games are divisional, being St. Louis and Pittsburgh and Toronto up against Tampa Bay, they're both divisional games. But the World Series rematch game, I'm going with Kansas City. I think they got a lot of emotion with them receiving you know, championship value, their fans, and the last time they seen all of these fans together was a million people out there in Kansas City partying with them as they brought the championship back to Missouri. I think Kansas City stays on top of their game and takes care of the Mets. And until the Mets can go out there and prove that they can take care of business, especially with some of their notables being out already, I think this is Kansas City's game to lose, if you will. Anything else in front of the game before we do get away from it? Because this is just the spark of Omni Day. I know we'll jump into more of it tomorrow during the wrap-up also.
You know, again, I think you're probably right with the Toronto and the Rays. I don't know too much about that division and those two teams. I think Toronto was the team that swooped up Tulowitzki last year, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct? But I don't know if you know, as I said, I don't know those teams very well, so I just threw out a name on those two. But again, with the Mets, I feel that team to me could or should have won the World Series. Again, I know the World was back to back for them. They lost the previous one. They had Redemption Road or whatever you want to call it. But I thought the Mets had the better pitching. They really couldn't get the runs that they needed. So to me, I think the Mets are going to come out, and I think Matt Harvey gets that first victory of the year for them. But you know, again, that's an exciting matchup, and I'm ready to see it.
Okay, well, we are at the tail end of the show. Definitely need plug and close out anything that you like to promote as we shut down the brunch. We will have an electric show tomorrow at the wrap up. That is for sure.
Yeah. You know, at Nacho on the Box, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Again, you said it. No, Syracuse loses and people don't show up, you know. Again, you know, just come in. We've all left and whatever, but don't come in running your mouth about other teams and anyone else because you just lost. So you need to come back, you know, sit quietly, take your turn, you know, and stop talking about other people losing when y'all are losing too. Other than that, man, it's fun. Good show today, me and you. I enjoyed it. You know, wish Chandler would have been here. Probably got a little more in that baseball take. I know tomorrow we'll definitely dive into that. Diamondbacks open up tomorrow. That's going to be interesting. I will definitely probably miss tomorrow's you know, sports wrap-up going to the Diamondbacks opener. But after that on Tuesday, I would definitely love to talk about the game and definitely talk about the conditions of the ballpark. If you haven't read about the Arizona Diamondbacks and the problems that they're having with the ballpark and say if that they don't fix it, they're moving, although I think their contract runs for the next 10 years or 9 years in that ballpark. So I don't know exactly how that's going to turn out or what's going to happen with that, but I'll definitely talk about that on Tuesday as it pertains to the park because I've been in the park recently and I don't understand what the players are talking about. Now, if they're talking about their inside, you know, the clubhouse and things of that nature. I can't imagine the clubhouse or the locker room being anything less than perfect when you see what the stadium has for you. And again, I'm not there every day in and day out living my life there as a professional, but as a fan walking through there, I don't know what they're talking about, the conditions and that nature. It's a place that you can turn the AC on especially in these hot summers. So I don't understand what they're talking about. Other than that, man, it was a great show, and I'm definitely excited for baseball, more excited than I've possibly been in any time that I can remember, thanks to this show, thanks to the chefs, and thanks to the baseball guys that have, you know, pumped some knowledge into my brain about the game. So I'm just excited about, you know, opening day and these games going. You know, Granky and the Diamondbacks, hopefully we can pull off this NL West, you know, and do what we're supposed to do. So I love the fact that everyone's underrating us and everyone thinks that this team is not going to do much, and I love it. So I love being the underdog and being, you know, discounted as a fan of a team, especially when I believe that the team is pretty good, not necessarily the best in the league. Obviously, I don't know that much knowledge about every team, but I think we're way better than we were last year. And with quite possibly the league MVP and Paul Goldschmidt for 2016, I think we're going to be ready and ready to go.
No doubt. We got a week loaded now. Now I'm 6 days out of the week. They won't even let me take Wednesday off. The baseball buffet was pretty good this past week. A lot of people came and checked that out, downloaded it. Keep showing us that love and support, Sports City. Keep sharing and tweeting, doing what y'all need to do. We'll be back here tomorrow with the Monday Night Sports Wrap-Up, National Championship Edition, Day 2 of Opening Day in the MLB. A lot of stuff to jump into. I wish Sirius was here because the Rockets and the Thunder go at it. The Thunder go to Houston, a matchup up against the Rockets in a marquee matchup. So this is going to be pretty big. I don't get to talk junk, but rest in peace to my cousin, Thomas Powell, because he was a diehard Rockets fan, and I will never forget you, cousin, because of how big this matchup is in our lives. SportsCityChefs.com. Check out the website, the interviews, the blogs, the chefs. You already know how this go down, Sports City. Electric show, electric stuff. Thank you to Mr. Silva, all the people out there in Arizona. I still think that the Diamondbacks have the coolest stadium or arena or however your stadium in baseball. They got a pool in center field. I don't care what nobody says. You can go swimming during a baseball game. On that note, tell a friend to tell a friend that it's the chefs again. And if they don't know, now they know.
Oh, welcome to Sports City. TP Thomas is at the helm.
Feeling kind of Sunday.
Moses taking care of the Midwest. I'm TP Thomas holding down the East Coast.
TP, I am ready to back rock.
And the only thing, I got one thing to wish you people.
Good morning.
It's a Sports City Chef with Sunday the Brunch with Mark and TP.
Good morning.
So kick back, relax, enjoy everybody, don't turn on the TV.
Good morning.
It's a Sunday morning brunch with Mark the Moses and TP Thomas.
Good morning.
So sit back, relax, in 2 hours of facts, and that's a fact, yeah.